since early as time, alcohol has been viewed essentially from three aspects. I mean, alcohol has been utilized as nutrition, as a food. In many areas, it is defined as a food because it does give calories if you consume it. I mean, there is a caloric content for alcohol. Now, it's also a valuable medicine. For a long time, it's been utilized as this. Its principal action is that of an anesthetic, in spite of what many people will tell you. It is an anesthetic. It might be used in a diet of diabetics because it doesn't require insulin. It's been used to treat arthritis, degenerative diseases, high blood pressure, coronary disease. It's often used as a tranquilizer, probably the most used tranquilizer. And even when you don't need a tranquilizer, and an sedative for a geriatric patient. It has also been used as a sacred liquid. Has been and continues to be used as such. But although these are the three main uses for it, or sort of the public uses, it is not the main use. The main use for it is as an antidote to unpleasant reality, a need for an ego booster, an aid to sociability, and just simple pleasure. It's always been a problem. I can go back to Egyptian writing, for example, back about 3,000 years ago, when the Egyptians wrote, "Take not upon thyself to drink a jug of beer," it advocated. "Thou speakest, and an unintelligible utterance issueth from thy mouth. If thou fallest down and thy limbs break, there is none to hold out a hand to thee. Thy companions in drink stand by and say, away with this thought, and thou art like a little child." So it's not a new problem. Now, what is the nature of the problem and some of the definitions? I should tell you probably initially that the majority of people do drink. The majority of the people that drink are not problem drinkers. I'll get into some of the statistics later. Those that are problem drinkers, however, affect the entire American society. And the misery that they cause themselves and others is enormous. Perhaps I should use even a stronger word. The definition of a problem drinker, of course, varies. For a teetotaling group of people, anyone who takes a drink is a problem drinker. In Normandy, in France, in Brittany, in the Britain area of France, I guess it is, and certain businesses here in the United States and certain social groups here in the United States, one who drinks very little or nothing is a problem drinker, by definition. Among certain communal drinkers, I mean where you get together and drink, the one who drinks alone would be a problem drinker. In Northern Europe, the one who drinks wine is a problem drinker. You better watch that guy. Or in Southern Europe, it's the opposite, where they drink a lot of wine and beer. The guy that hits the hard liquor is the problem drinker. So it depends on who you ask. Realistically, problem drinkers are those who cause significant damage to themselves, their families, or their communities because of drinking. In this publication by the National Institutes of Health, they give this definition, which is relatively commonly accepted as far as alcoholism is concerned. Alcoholism is a chronic disease or disorder of behavior characterized by repeated drinking of alcoholic beverages to an extent that exceeds customary dietary use or ordinary compliance with the social drinking customs of the community, and which interferes with the drinker's health, interpersonal relations, or economic functioning. And a fellow at the Medical College of Virginia, he sort of looked at it from three standpoints, or three criteria. There is a loss of control of alcohol intake. The victim finds himself drinking when he intends not to drink, or drinking more than he planned. There is functional or structural damage, physiological, psychologically, domestic, economic, or social. And alcohol is used as a kind of universal therapy, where the problem drinker attempts to keep his life from disintegrating. I know some of you may wish to give other definitions as we proceed here. But of course, the arguments do go on about the definition, whether it's a disease, a symptom of immorality, a weakness, or a self-indulgence. I will probably assess these as we go on. Now, a little bit on the present attitude. There has been some change in this in the last couple of decades, really. In 1956, the American Medical Association made a statement where they regarded that alcoholism must be regarded as within the purview of medical practice. That is, it is a medical problem. Now, up to this time, I mean, this was a remarkable statement, and some people regarded it as a result of this. There occurred a dramatically altered position regarding the alcoholic. It has brought a lot of those that were sort of hidden into the open. And there have been a couple of significant court rulings on this. One in North Carolina, in the U.S. Court of Appeals, I think it was, that a public drunkenness conviction was reversed or overturned on the grounds that it was unconstitutional to punish a person for acts that he could not control. And in District of Columbia, in the U.S. Court of Appeals, they ruled that chronic alcoholism is not a crime. If one can prove chronic alcoholism, the defendant has lost the power of self-control in the use of intoxicating beverages. There are also, of course, a very disturbing thing, perhaps this is as good a place as any to bring it up, about the relaxed attitude towards this. I think I'll wait for a little while. If I don't bring it up, you remind me of it. And I'll give you a couple of examples that are very disturbing.
But the analogy that they often use here relative to the chronic alcoholic is that he can't control it any more than a tuberculosis patient is responsible for his coughing. Now, this disease concept can maintain merely provide the alcoholic with a comforting alibi and has no responsibility for further drinking, so he just goes on. Now, I better give you correct a couple of misinterpretations here, which I call baloney. And there's two hunks of baloney on this, that most of the alcoholics are on skid row. They made surveys of this, and it's about less than half of the people are on skid row are really alcoholics. In fact, some of them are teetotalers, for one reason or another. 70% of the alcoholics live in responsible neighborhoods. I mean, they're responsible, they're regarded as responsible citizens in well-to-do neighborhoods. The other piece of baloney is that we should establish a safe level for drinking. Now, France tried to do this. They said, well, let's set it as a liter of wine a day. Of course, right away you said, well, what kind of wine is it? Because France right now has a real problem on alcoholism, and one of the worst things, of course, are the liqueurs, the after-dinner wines, which are fairly high in alcoholic content, I suppose up to 25%. And this has become a real problem with them. And then they finally sort of gave it up as a bad job because, as I said earlier, it's when he drinks, how he drinks, and why he drinks. It is the real problem. Now, what is the extent of the... What is it really costing us, and really what is the extent of drinking and the dimension of the problem? The real tough part of it is, when you start citing statistics, is that you know they're wrong. And chances are they're underestimated, because
I know on our own campus at the University of California, Davis, I know quite a few members of the faculty who really have a drinking problem, and some of them are what I call alcoholics, because they got a habit, you know, and they really got a fix on it. And where you can tell this is if they often do, they have something that's become very popular in some parts of the United States today, is wine tasting, you know. And if you go to one of these wine tasting things, you know, the way you taste wine, they tell me, is that you they line up the bottles here, and then you're just supposed to put in just a little bit, you know, and then you check it for aroma, I guess, and then you take a little bit in, then you sort of rinse out your mouth, you know. Well, I think I can just stand back. I've gone to these things to more or less to observe, you know, because this kind of an experience for me. And I can tell these fellows, you know, these old professors, they come in, they're not someone's old, you know. You know, they pour in about six gloves, you know, like this, you know, and down the hatch, you know. And by the time they get to the third ton of wine, I mean, they're not sure whether it's the third bottle or the fourth one, you know? I mean, that isn't how you taste wine. And they got a problem. They got a very serious problem. And some people in positions of very responsibility. A good friend of mine is one of the deans there. And I always worry about people who have double martinis for lunch, you know? Because you compromise your position. I'm often invited to the House because there's interviewing the new faculty and so forth. And I watch him, maybe the bartender leaves for a while, he goes over to the bar and he mixes his own, you know? And there isn't much water. You know, I mean, and this is a problem. And several of my friends, I mean, one of them was already left because he couldn't. Well, he wasn't going to get tenure, so he's somewhere else now. But these fellows really aren't counted in the statistics, you see. Now, about what is the size of the problem? Well, varying numbers. Some people say, well, we have probably 5 million alcoholics in the United States right now. Some will raise this figure up to as high as 9 million. They say that we're adding them at the rate of about 200,000 to 300,000 a year. And you can stop and figure out how many there are this hour that we're talking, if you want to. And probably of all those who start drinking, there's probably one out of every 12 to one out of every 15 or 18 who will go down the tubes as an alcoholic. At least probably one out of eight will become a problem drinker. That is, it's going to affect his situation. Now, how do you define a problem drinker? Now, I'll interrupt this to tell you a very sad story to show you how I regard sort of a problem drinker. Last November, on a Friday afternoon, as I often did, I had a short interview with the most brilliant graduate student I've ever had. His name is Irving Hertzendorf. He was a veterinarian. He was taking a PhD in physiology, and I was his advisor. He had finished all his requirements for a PhD, and he was working on his research, and he was on a pretty hot subject. He was an unusually capable young fellow, very sensitive, kind, and very knowledgeable, interested in just about everything. I enjoyed him very much. I had a very strong feeling for him, and he, I think, for me. And on this Friday afternoon, just before he left, he told me about, boy, things were really looking good. It was one of the best days he's had as far as the search goes. And we were both happy about the situation. He always left early on Friday evenings, and because he wanted to get home before sundown, because he was he tried to be an Orthodox Jew, at least as Orthodox as you can, you know, under those circumstances. And within 5 minutes after I talked to him, he jumped on his bicycle, went out, and he was hit by a hit-and-run driver, probably going 70 miles an hour. He was hauled through the air about 90 feet or so, and 11 days later, he died. in a coma from which he never regained consciousness. Now, what are the circumstances here? This fellow that hit him was a 62-year-old fellow with a lot of problems. One of them was a drinking problem. He was probably not a chronic alcoholic. He had had an operation and a minor surgery that morning. He had a tranquilizer. But then he went home and he worked on the farm. The boss said, you can take the afternoon off, so he decided he'd belt a couple. And there were some university students who decided also to belt a few. They were all underage. They were having a beer party down on the farm. And he saw him out there, so he decided to chase him off the farm. And they got in a kind of an argument. The kid jumped in their car, took off, and he was chasing them. That's how we know he's going 70 miles an hour. Now, who was responsible? To me, somebody had a problem, huh? And this is a great tragedy. This was, of course, a very great personal tragedy for me. It was a greater personal tragedy because he had a wife and a one-year-old child. Now, I think those students have a real problem because they have to share in the death of this most unusual fellow. And I don't care who the fellow was, they would have helped kill someone. The fellow is now free. He served about 6 months in jail, the fellow that hit him. So perhaps if I appear on occasion somewhat subjective on this subject, there is probably a very good reason for it. Within California, the alcohol problem is costing us as taxpayers probably about $1 billion a year. Well, how do I figure that? Well, it's the leading single diagnosis in all mental hospitals. In other words, the alcohol problem is responsible for many of the cases that reside in our mental hospitals, or it's certainly involved in them. It's usually not, and as far as the crime rate goes, almost half of the arrests made in the United States that are reported by the FBI were for drunkenness, or things associated with drunkenness. So you can figure out if we didn't have this problem, we could get by with half the police force, huh? And half the local constabulary, as we in the common vernacular refer to as the local feds. Now, this figure does not involve or include the homicides, the assault, the offense against children, and theft, which alcohol is often involved in. And the other thing that I want to point out here is that of accidents on the highways. Now, it has been variously, and there have been quite a few surveys on this, and we are now killing people on the highways at the rate of 50,000 a year dead, and considerably in excess of 1 million that are seriously damaged. 1.8 million disabling injuries, I think, 2 years ago. And accidents, the cost of these accidents are over 9 billion in property damage. Now, from 60 to 87% of these, depending on which survey you look at, there was alcohol involved in the accident. Now, if you figure out this, that's a lot more people dead, severely injured, than things like the Vietnam War, as far as our people are concerned. Now, this is a pretty big problem. Now, and what is not included, of course, as one assesses all this, is just what we're paying for alcohol here, huh? I mean, what is the alcohol bill in the United States? What will the money do? The money will build and equip a city of 1 million people a year, provide them cars, places to live, and so forth. $11.7 billion worth in, I think, 65. This is probably more than all the contributions to the churches and for education and probably some other things in this United States. This is the liquor bill itself. And how about industry? Industry refers to this as a $2 billion hangover because of what it does to its employees. I was with the General Electric Company for 16 years. And it's only recently, within the last two decades, that they have really faced up to the issue. Now, a good deal of money is spent to try to prevent alcoholism within the management team, and also try to recover the people. But it's a real problem. And there's a lot of them that go down the tubes, of course, with this, which is costly not only to the person, but also to the industry. Now, in spite of all these very imposing figures that I have given you, the biggest cost, of course, is in human suffering, which is incalculable. You can't calculate it. The destructive effects on unhappy marriages, broken homes, desertion, divorce, impoverished families, deprived and displaced children, it approaches, it's almost overwhelming. So that gives you some of the dimensions of the problem. Well, what does it do to the person as far as his health goes? Well, probably those who are problem drinkers, or were, their lifespan is estimated to have been shortened probably 10 or 12 years. It, of course, I've already mentioned the mental problems that do arise. Some of them, of course, resort to alcohol because they already have a problem, which, of course, isn't helped by this. There can be brain damage, of course, as many of you know, with the high levels of intake. You see cirrhosis of the liver in people like this. But as far as putting down the cause of death, it's alcoholism or heavy alcohol. You just don't do this, you know. Or at least people don't bring themselves to this. You might do it with a derelict. You see, somebody you scrape up down in the bowel. You might say he died from alcoholism, you know. But are they going to say that the leading businessman in town died from alcoholism, even if he did? Listed as a cause of death? You better believe it. They wouldn't, in most places. What is its action? It dilates the peripheral blood vessels, and therefore, of course, lowers the blood pressure. And that's one of the reasons for its utilization medicinally. Increases the heart rate. It may increase the appetite, as well as urine production. It increases, or at least the nutritional deficiencies. And this is one of the real problems in this. And it lowers your resistance to infection. One of the reasons for this is it does lower your white blood cell count. Okay, we're getting on to the point here where I'm going to call for, not testimonials, but... and some of you know the causes better than I do. I'm going to summarize some of the animal work, too. We hear a lot about difference in ethnic groups, and it's true. Although the Jews now are drinking a lot more, I mean, the Jewish community in this country. But heretofore, you saw hardly any alcoholism or real problem drinking among the Jewish community, and certainly not in the Orthodox community. And that's also true generally of the Southern Europeans. Alcohol is consumed in fairly large quantities in Italy, but up until fairly recently, there was a fairly low incidence of alcoholism or problem drinking. The real problem drinking is in Northern European countries or those ethnic backgrounds and among the Irish. The Irish have the highest rates up until at least recently. I could read you some of the statistics, but I don't think we'll take time to do this. Now, why is this, of course? Is there a physiological, a genetic defect? Is it a psychological hang-up? Is there such a thing as an alcoholic personality? Probably Jerry will want to assess this. There's a lot of people that say there isn't one. The only thing that they have in common is that they like, they demand alcohol. And that's the one trait that separates them out. And maybe we can get into that. So I'm just going to be a discussion initiator there, even though I have some ideas on it. Now, in the area in which I operate, that is in experimental animal research, there, of course, have been many attempts at trying to hook an animal to use as an experimental model. Dr. Williams, who was one of the great scientists up until he died just a few years ago, Roger Williams down in Texas, was a great nutritionist, and he was very concerned about the alcohol problem, and he thought maybe it was something unique in the biochemistry of the individual. And he was working at it from a nutritional aspect. And he worked a lot on rats, and he had a lot of rats available, and so he allowed these rats to either have water or various percentages of alcohol. And he noticed that among these rats, that some of them never bothered with the alcohol. Others would take a nip now and then. Others would sort of, go on a bender. I mean, they'd hit it real hard and then they'd lay off for a while. And others got to be sure they were hitting it pretty regularly. You could take them away and they wouldn't have the sort of withdrawal symptoms. They really didn't get addicted to something. And then he did an interesting experiment. He changed their diet. And under certain dietary regimens, he could really lower their consumption of alcohol. And then he also, when they exposed them to distress, I mean, when they were supposed to be sleeping, he caused a lot of noise and kind of disrupt them. And of course, more of them turned to the bottle marked alcohol under these conditions. So it was an interesting experiment. Now, this was applied by Dr. Starr and others, Dr. Starr at Harvard. And they thought maybe this was really a good thing. They could really help out alcoholics in ways they could improve their nutrition or have high amino acid content in their diet, certain amino acids, and this type of thing. But you see, you're usually not successful with this. It may work if you could get them to do it, but you have to stand over them and keep injecting them with it, or make them do it because, they take all over the hill and go on another bout, and then they become they don't take their nutritional tablets with them. You see, so the thing really hasn't given a test. They usually say, "Well, it didn't work." Well, it may work if you could really get it to go. Now, two of the other antihistamines you'd like, but there is a strain of mice that has been developed that has a great. It rather likes alcohol. If you put alcohol in water in there, this strain prefers the alcohol and will drink it in quite large quantities. But we don't know whether this is a good model or not because they have an ability, inborn, they're getting their biochemistry of the body into the body. They are able to metabolize the alcohol much more rapidly than the other strains of rice, alcohol mice. But it is an interesting investigation. Having some success, I think, in getting rhesus monkeys to take alcohol, what they do is to stress them. Give them a stress situation, and they have them, of course, to alcohol, to imbibing alcohol this way, as they have also in drug addiction and hooks in them. And some of them appear to be hitting the bottle after the stress has left and has been removed. So there is a little promise there. Pigs have only been used, they've been put on wine, and they rather enjoy it. And they found out that they had a better feed utilization because they were far more tranquil, they slept a lot, and then they'd go and feed at the trough. Except those that had a little too much, and they kind of raised king, and kind of messed up the detail. But generally speaking, there was an increase in feed utilization. I believe, I'll just summarize. Well, no, I'm going to open up for discussion. Some of you can tell how it's treated. And then I'll mention that one of the, there's a recent release on a treatment by John Project with Stadell and a large manufacturing company. On the new ages. But why don't you start off, Gary, and tell something or say something? If you want to say something. Pardon?
Do you want to know what the sound of the treatment
is? Yeah, or any other aspect of alcoholism that you'd like to address.
One of the things that I've been
Can you everybody hear it?
No.
You've got to speak loudly here. I think we'll go to the Koinonia for the next hour, right? Have you been able to hear me here?
Yeah.
You have to speak very loudly here, but...
One of the common causes of death of alcoholism that you didn't mention yet is pneumonia.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of... apparently, aside from accidents, this is one of the very common...
Yeah, I should have mentioned that you have a reduced, your immunity is reduced, and of course they get exposed, you know, they don't know that they feel hot, but they're really cold, and you know.
But as far as the treatments are concerned, there are two very promising kinds of treatments now. One of them I visited in Seattle, I know it's on the coast or somewhere.
Yeah.
Where they use, it's something very much like antabuse. I'm not sure if that's what it is.
Well, no, you go ahead.
And it's a type of what psychologists call aversive stimulation or negative reinforcement, or the kind of conditioning where these people are, when they're first admitted, every hour, when they're first brought in, of course, this isn't very much for a lot of these patients, they're given some alcohol. But with that alcohol, or just preceding the alcohol, they're given a nausea, a drug that causes nausea, so that eventually these people are sort of reluctant anymore to take this alcohol, and it's still fed to them. And what the aim of this clinic is to build up such a resistance to the taking of alcohol that every time you take it, it makes them sick. That they claim, and I've read some of this research, they claim as high as a 60-80% cure rate of a follow-up of one of the studies was 3 years, and then it was again and repeated after 5 years. And the statistics were between 60-80% cure, which is, in this kind of literature, just fantastic. Most people say something like 10% is a very high cure rate if we're talking about a 5-year follow-up for alcoholism. But one of the centers that I've had a lot of contact with in Minnesota is Hazelden in Center City, Minnesota. And they have a unique program, one that has never anywhere else been tried, where they have a three-point kind of program. They very definitely, as part of their program, use the Alcoholics Anonymous 12 steps, where they have a series of, and I won't go through the 12 steps, but just the sort of beginning and ending one, where they first commit, they realize that they're powerless under the influence of alcohol, and that there must be something greater than themselves that helps them, whether it's Alcoholics Anonymous or God or something, they turn themselves to a higher power. And it ends up finally with the joining of AA and with the desire to help other people recovering from alcoholism. And there are 10 intermediate steps. Now, this is one fact of this program. Another one is architecture. The theory here is that alcoholics have a definite personality makeup. One of the factors is they're very dependent people, that they especially are dependent on a mother figure. That's part of this theory used in Hazelden. But they also, in order to sort of compensate for this, have a personality that stresses self-importance. So that at this particular center, unlike many of them, which are very much like a hospital, they have plush architecture all over. Magnificent paintings, high carpets, you know, the furniture just really good, and it's built just like a country club. It's a 3-week program that they must stay here in this hospital, and it is a hospital, but it looks like a country club. And Hazelden is quite convinced that this improves their cure rate, that these people really have a feeling while they're there that they're very important, rather than kind of low down on the scale as most people look at alcoholics. And the next point is that they stress very, very much group therapy and individual therapy by recovered alcoholics. Their entire staff, with the exception of one person, is made up of recovered alcoholics. And they have a feeling that these are the only people who really can relate in group therapy to the other alcoholics. And they put a real high stress on continual group therapy during the 3-week stay. And they now have some literature indicating around a 70% cure rate. This is now a center that's getting a lot of attention. A lot of people, especially in Canada and other places in the